Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, everybody. Before we get started, I want to say thanks to all of you who have made us part of your listening diet during this crazy time. Our routines are all in chaos, and Lord knows there is more media out there than I can personally take in right now. So if you're tuning into us each week, it suggests that we're doing something that is truly useful for you, and I'm just really proud of that. So thank you. And also, if you haven't heard our most recent episode on the life and work of Ida B. Wells, be sure to add that to your queue because it's very much a companion piece to the one you are about to hear. And again, thanks for listening. I'm Kai Wright, and this is The United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future. I am maxed out on hearing about mortality. So when the sadly predictable news broke recently that yet another Black person had been killed in vigilante violence,
Ahmaud Arbery was jogging through a neighborhood in Brunswick, Georgia, when two white men in a truck confronted him and then one shot him.
Pressure is. I admit I did my best to just tune it out.
This week, video of the incident surfaced and further inflamed the community. Last night,
of course, that is not useful either. I can just hear Ida Wells yelling at me from the past, reminding me that the only way to stop anti-Black violence is to confront it directly. Head on, eyes open. And Ahmaud Arbery's killing is absolutely part of more than a century worth of lynching that Ida began documenting in the 1890s. Still, in this episode, I wanted to talk to somebody who has tried to process that history emotionally by making art. Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya published a short story collection called Friday Black in 2018 to rave reviews and all kinds of prizes. His stories are intense and often dystopian, but also weird and funny and moving. And some of them deal quite graphically with anti-Black violence. Oddly enough, in a way that makes me feel sane. So I called him up last week. Nana, thanks for taking time to talk with me today. We've been talking about your book on our team for a while now, and with the news of Ahmaud Arbery's killing, it just felt like the moment to pick your brain and reflect on your writing. And I'm always curious in these conversations as a place to start is just like, did you watch the video?
Yeah, I have not watched the video. For me, there's sort of a... I remember very specifically watching Philando Castile on the video with him. And my response was sort of very visceral and was not good for my anxiety at all. And I kind of decided, like, you know, I think that's it for me, really watching those videos. I think I saw maybe on Twitter by force, like 5 seconds of the beginning, and then I just like exited out really quick. So
it was actually the Philando Castile video was the one that I had the same moment where I decided I'm just not watching them anymore. I can't take this in.
Mm-hmm. It was a brutal time. And I think, you know, it weighed on you. And you started to realize I didn't need a confirmation or something. You know, I understood what was happening, but seeing it was hurting me. So
yeah.
I stopped.
Like, what is it offering? But I have to say, though, then it like, I mean, for one, it also feels like just this spectacle, you know, this spectacle of anti-Black violence. And I wrestle with that because at the same time, you know, it is that spectacle. It is that video that led the case.
Let us know.
Yeah, and they got the case back into public attention and into under investigation. And it's, I don't know, it's kind of crazy making that we need the spectacle to care, I guess.
Yeah, and, you know, that spectacle and making people care is, you know, very much connected to my work, I think.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think I can, especially maybe some stories in my book, like the Finkelstein Five, that very phenomenon of needing it to be as grotesque as possible, as violent as possible to care about Black life is something I think I'm aware of and can understand. But I guess, you know, and I don't think that the video shouldn't exist. For me, it's just that I know for me, it does harm.
Well, let's in fact talk about the Finkelstein Five, that story. And there are actually a few stories in the collection that feel to me about the spectacle of anti-Black violence.
Yeah.
But they're also, what I find interesting is that they're also about, really about the way we as Black people process that violence.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm going to ask you to read a piece from the Finkelstein Five to start us off. But just to set this up, in the story, there are five Black children who are murdered by a white guy outside of a library.
Mm-hmm.
The guy thinks they're loitering and are a threat, so he gets a chainsaw and cuts off their heads. And for anybody who hasn't read the collection, the stories are kind of like that. They're fantastic and dystopian and intense. But again, they're also about the internal lives of the Black characters that I find really relatable. So I think in this moment you're going to read from, this is where the main character, Emmanuel, he's heard the news of the murders and he's on his way to a job interview, and he's not decided to do his usual thing of trying to mute his Blackness.
Emmanuel stepped outside into the world, his Blackness at a solid 7.6. He felt like Evel Knievel at the top of a ramp. At the mall, he looked for something to wear to the interview, something to bring him down to at least a 4.2. He pulled the brim of his hat forward and down to shade his eyes. He walked up a hill toward Canfield Road, where he'd catch a bus. He listened to the gravel scraping under his sneakers. It had been a very long time since he'd had his Blackness even close to 7.0. "I want you safe. You gotta know how to move," his father had said to him at a very young age. Emmanuel started learning the basics of his Blackness before he knew how to do long division. Smiling when angry, whispering when he wanted to yell. Back when he was in middle school, after a trip to the zoo where he'd been accused of stealing a stuffed panda from the gift shop, Emmanuel had burned his last pair of baggy jeans in his driveway. He'd watched the denim curl and ash in front of him with unblinking eyes. When his father came outside, Emmanuel imagined he'd get a good talking to. Instead, his father stood quietly beside him. "This is an important thing to learn," his father had said. Together, they watched the fire until it ate itself dead.
What's going on for him in this moment? Like, what is it you're trying to do with him?
I think early on in the story, you know, he's trying to figure out, like, you know, what to do. He needs something to do. He feels a lot of anger. He feels a lot of sorrow. He feels a lot of things, but he's not sure what to do. But he also feels, I think, in Emmanuel's case, maybe particularly implicated because he's a young Black person who is able to code switch in this way. And, you know, I think sort of the idea, a sort of evidence in that sort of scene that I just read is that, you know, if you're able to do this thing, if you burn your last pair of baggy jeans, you know, that's a way of being safe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, by extension and by extrapolation, maybe those kids would have survived if they looked different or presented differently while Black. And so I think he feels almost like a guilt associated with that ideology, realizing, you know, that can't, you know, there's a limit to that. And so he's sort of pushing against it in this, like, sort of silent solidarity, or at least that first silent solidarity, by dressing in this way that he knows will rise his quote-unquote Blackness in the eyes of many.
It's similar to what we just got through talking about for ourselves, that he's trying to figure out how to take in what happened to these kids. And we have talked on this show a lot about the history of lynching and anti-Black violence. And it's, I'm just struck by how long Black people have been doing what Emmanuel is doing there and trying to figure out how do I react to it?
And it's not like some theoretical thing that's some faraway history. It's in our recent history. We understand like the history of American lynchings and how that is not even a generation away. That's us. And so who you are when your life is sort of at stake and trying to still be yourself and be proud of yourself, but also just having the very human fear and sorrow and pain. I think it's almost scary to think of how much of your life is shaped by that kind of wondering.
Yeah. A spoiler alert for folks, what Emmanuel goes on to do, how he processes this is he joins a movement where Black folks are responding to violence with violence and almost this sort of ritualistic killings, which to me seems like an extreme response. But I've heard you talk about the fact that you don't consider many of the scenarios in your book, including this one, to be extreme. What do you mean by that?
So yeah, the Namers, the Israel, they dress up very well and, you know, in like their Sunday best, and then they kill people. They kill white people indiscriminately in response to the sort of long history that we're talking about. And for me, you know, I think that violence is very, very often met with violence. And for me, it's necessary to think about, because in this moment like we have right now, it's scary to see just how, in the case of those who are fighting and clamoring and getting armed to force the nation's hand into reopening, how they're willing to kill you, but also themselves in this case even.
Right.
They're willing to sacrifice both you and me and themselves to protect this thing. And so I guess what I'm saying is all that makes me feel even more inclined to understand those who are like, well, it's time to like clip up, basically. I want that view to be taken seriously,
yeah,
even if I don't agree with it and know that it's maybe short-sighted and myopic to turn to violence.
Well, especially here in the United States, where it just seems like there's such a currency on violence in our politics, in our culture, everywhere, just violence.
And I mean, I think I've been thinking about this for a while because I haven't really had a chance to travel prior to this book. I've, you know, spent most of my life within like 300 miles of where I was born or 100 miles of where I was born. And I hadn't seen much, but because like the sort of story is America is like sort of the end all be all of all things. And this year when I've gone to travel a little bit, I'm sort of like looking for the thing that, aside from its diversity, which is to me the thing that is pretty beautiful and special, the thing that America feels it's so, why we think we're the best. And I think it's a capacity for violence. I think it's really like we have the biggest gun, basically, or guns. And obviously we have so much more to offer, but I think America really does rest on its capacity for violence and the sort of potential for violence. And it's maybe not even violence, but like its ability to like win or triumph in like a sort of very simple sense.
To dominate, you know, with force.
To dominate with force. And it's sad because it's ultimately it's an illusion that for me to win, you have to lose. And I think that's very close to this American idea as well. We think that the only way to succeed is through like that domination, when sometimes you get reminded really obviously that you have to work together. And I think the virus is sort of a metaphor for that in some ways.
Yeah. One of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is you've really got roots in the parts of the city that and the state that have been most devastated by COVID-19. You live in the Bronx now, right?
Yep. I love it here. There's a community here, but it's scary though as well, because we just went up the block to the bodega to get like this water and this juice I'm drinking right now. And we have a food pantry up there. The line goes down the block.
Yeah.
Because people are really in it right now. And it's hard because it is such a place that is still like alive, and there's people outside usually all the time. There's usually music playing probably too loudly all the time. There's usually a lot going on, and it's not like that anymore. And it's pretty tough.
Yeah. It feels like a lot of the book is sort of, a lot of stories in the book sort of echo the community there, and it's just so uniquely New York in this sort of, collection of, like, as I read, you don't really identify the race of most of the characters, I think, but I read them all as black and brown. And maybe that's just because I had New York in my mind.
And I appreciate that because, I think it's, for me, there is like a sense of wanting to represent what isn't always represented in fiction or quote unquote literary fiction. I'm the son of two Ghanaian immigrants, and I was born in Queens. I moved to Rockland County. My high school, we had like, in my graduating class, we had less than 10 white people. So I was used to many different people being around each other at once. And I think that sort of diversity, and not just racial, but like in multiple senses, you know, I think in my own life, in my younger life, I feel like I've gone through like several different like socioeconomic spaces. It's made me realize that people can be a lot of different things. There's so many different ways of sort of grabbing at love, really. Mm. And some of those ways are uglier than others, but you know, everybody does it somehow.
Some of those ways are uglier than others? What do you mean by that?
In my stories, I like to think that rather than like having like obvious villains, it's like these institutions that sort of trick you into thinking that this person in front of you is denying you from being able to do what you want. The example that comes to mind is in Friday Black, where we have these shoppers who are screaming and killing, and you know, it's like almost like Black Friday on a million times steroids.
That's probably my favorite story in the collection, and I wanted to have you read from it. So let's do that since you brought it up. And just to set up the section I think you're going to read, it's the start of the story where there's a young man who's working in a mall on Black Friday. He's the star seller of the mall because he makes such good numbers. And this is another sort of fantastic dystopian scenario where the shoppers are essentially zombies and he's able to understand them. And this is the moment where the store has opened for business and Black Friday is about to begin.
So this is Friday Black. She's pushed the button and turned the key. The main gate eats itself as it rose into the ceiling. "Get out of here," I yell to Richard. He runs to the register. Will he be back up to the backup safe? Maybe 80 people rush to the gate, clawing and stampeding, pushing racks and bodies aside. Have you ever seen people run from a fire or gunshots? It's like that, with less fear and more hunger. From my cabin, I see a child, a girl maybe 6 years old, disappear as a wave of consumer fervor swallows her up. She sprawled face down with dirty shoe prints on her pink coat. Lance walks up to the small pink body. He's pulling a pallet jack and holding a huge push broom. He thrusts the broom head into her side and tries to sweep her onto the pallet jack so he can roll her to the section we've designated for bodies. As he touches her, a woman wearing a gray scarf pushes him away and yanks the girl to her feet. I imagine the mother explaining that her tiny daughter isn't dead yet. She pulls the little girl toward me. The girl limps and tries to keep up, and then I have to forget about them. "Blue Sun Sleek Puck!" A man with wild eyes and a bubble vest screams as he grabs my left ankle. White foam drips from his mouth. I use my right foot to stamp his hand, and I feel his fingers crush beneath my boots. He howls, "Sleek Puck, son!" while licking his injured hand. I look him in the eyes, deep red around the corners. I understand him perfectly. What he's saying is this: My son loves me most on Christmas. I have him holidays, me and him. Once the one thing, only thing, his mother won't on me need to feel like father. Ever since the first time, since the bite, I can speak Black Friday. Or I can understand it at least. Not fluently, but well enough. I have some of them in me. I hear the people, the sizes, the model, the make, and the reason, even if all they're doing is foaming at the mouth. I use my reach and pull a medium-sized blue sleek pack pole face from the face-out rack way up on the wall. "Thanks," he growls when I throw the jacket in his face.
I was so drawn when I read that to the moment where he translates the emotional reality of the consumption for the zombie buyer. Can you talk about that, this idea of the emotional consumption?
Yeah, I think, you know, it isn't as simple as people suck because they buy stuff. You know, I really did work in the mall for a long time, and I've done the whole Black Friday thing several times. And I also did really win my mom a jacket because I was like, I don't have money and I have to get her something. Mm-hmm. And so for me, most of marketing is getting people to conflate things and love. You know, if you can trick someone to thinking that this item, this physical item that I conveniently am selling is the key to you expressing this love and therefore making your love real in the world, then you have them. And I think that's what people do. And sometimes, you know, sometimes the person you're trying to show love to is yourself. I like myself and I want to feel good. So I need these X, Y, and Z.
Right.
And that's part of it.
I do it probably daily. I mean, the amount of compulsive shopping I've done since the beginning of this pandemic.
Yeah.
But, you know, and then I think about it in that context too, I have to say, you know, and maybe I'm stretching, but when I think about this story sort of in the context of the back to work imperative right now, mm-hmm. I guess I want to see if that resonates with you, that this idea that above all, we must buy and sell stuff, it means more than even our lives.
Literally more than I was just talking to my little sister about this yesterday. It's insane. If I'm not making things, I'm not a person. And, you know, and again, that also resonates with me as well, because I think, you know, I was very, very driven to be an author and write a book. And it was sort of like, if I don't do this, then I'm not even really a human being. I don't really even deserve to live. Mm. And so I understand that trick, but it's a trick. You know, it's a lie. You deserve everything if you produce nothing. You don't deserve to live because you can work in whatever space, but it's sick because it's in us, you know? It's like a self-cleaning oven or something.
You've talked about all of this a lot on Twitter since this has, since the pandemic has broken.
I always forget that people see my Twitter. I always forget that's like, I feel like kind of talking to myself, you know, then people reference it and I feel embarrassed. Sorry, go ahead.
It is a public platform, I have to tell you. Well, one of the things you've talked about, I saw you were one of the folks on Twitter who gave away money, who offered to pay people's bills.
Yeah.
Which I have to say, I've always found kind of awkward. And I just...
It is awkward.
I guess I want to hear... What made you do that? What were you thinking?
I think I was like panicking. And I might do it again. And I mean, I'm sure my account is like, I don't think you should ever do that again. But I saw one of my friends do it, someone I know from school, from college. And also, you know, I'm also like, this is one of the first periods in my life that I could pay my rent. And then after my rent is paid, I'm not feeling like that sort of feeling, you know? So I think it's that newly being able to pay my rent and my mom's rent and like not feel like impending doom. Plus, I saw someone else do it and I was like, well, screw it, I guess. Like, I'm going to do this too. Yeah. And I don't want to make it sound like I did something crazy. I think I probably gave out like less than $1,300 that day.
Yeah.
But anyways, I just did it. It is awkward. It's weird. But I just felt like I was panicking and I thought I can do something in this moment and maybe it's kind of weird or whatever. But also, you put it out there. You say, I'm going to do like 10 people. You get like 300 retweets now, you know, and now it's like, shit, I don't know. I don't regret it at all. I'm happy I did it. It wasn't, if I was a billionaire, I'd do more.
I appreciate you saying you were panicking. That's where a lot of us are, honestly. Yeah. I mean, we're just panicking and trying to figure out how do we move forward. Coming up, Nana reflects on love and loss amid a pandemic. And one more reading from his collection, Friday Black. That's next.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
What if millions of Black Americans had been compensated for slavery? Join me, Trymaine Lee, as I explore the untold story of one of the only Black Americans who ever was. I talk to his descendants and discuss how reparations forever changed their family's trajectory and imagine a reality where reparations are paid to the rest of Black America. Into America presents Uncounted Millions, The Power of Reparations, a Black History Month series. New episodes drop Thursdays. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the other things I wanted to talk to you about, Nana, that I think you might have insight for people on right now is you lost your father recently.
Yeah.
Before this all happened. And I've heard you talk about being young and losing a parent and coming to see them as in their full humanity in the course of that. And I just feel like there might be a whole lot of people who are in that position in New York City right now or in New York region right now. And I just wonder
right.
if you have anything to add for those folks from that process.
It's so hard because, I mean, that's part of it. That's kind of my answer is so hard and then period. Right after my father passed, like after the funeral, because that was a nightmare, just setting it up. But after that, I felt like a weird sense of like grace. I was really connected to like a sense that, oh my God, everybody is going to feel something like this at some point. And I felt like a really, really deep well of like empathy with like everything. You know what I mean? I was like, I think I was also probably like, you know, having a, like a episode, but I was also like connected to like every tree, like seriously, it was like really like, whoa. And then it changed and it became really dark and sad and scary. I think that the people who are going through that right now, that is losing a parent or someone who's raised them or struggling with them, is to know that like a lot of what you need, they've given you. You know, a lot of what you need, they've helped you with already. And also, like, you know, people have complicated relationships with their parents. That's like the other thing that kind of gets left out of it, you know. And that stuff, you're allowed to feel that way, too.
Well, the other thing I wanted you to read was the short story, Things My Mother Said.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a beautiful story about what we can learn from our elders right now, who, of course, are people who are just so at risk in this pandemic. So I'd just love to hear you read it.
Things My Mother Said. My mother's favorite thing to say to me was, "I am not your friend." She'd often say, "You are my firstborn son, my only son," as a reminder not to die. She loved saying, as a way to keep me humble, "I didn't have a mother. You're lucky. You have a mother." When the TV went dark, my mother said, "Good. Now you can read more." Then our house at the bottom of a hill lost all its life. Gas, water, electric. One day I came home to the warm smell of chicken and rice. I hadn't been able to steal a second burger in the cafeteria at school that day. My stomach whined. At home, the fridge had become a casket bearing nothing. The range and oven had become decorations meant to make a dying box look like a home. Hunger colored those days. "Where is this from?" I asked, already carving out a healthy portion from a worn gray pot. My mother pretended she didn't hear me. She was studying the pages of her massive white Bible at the kitchen table. Wide sheets of light pressed through the window and draped her. She spent her days reading that big Bible. Its pages wore to film as her fingers fluttered from psalm to psalm. She'd be asleep by the splash of dusk. I, on the other hand, would be up for hours, trying to do homework by the blue glow of my cell phone, clinging to its light until it died. At night, hunger and I huddled together. I'd fall asleep thinking one day I would change everything. That afternoon, I ate the chicken and rice. It tasted like pepper and smoke. "How did you make this, Mom?" I asked again. She looked up from her Bible. "Ara Dieu, did you pray over your food? Did you say your psalms today?" Ate the food quickly, greedily. I chewed the bones till they splintered in my mouth. Another thing my mother often said, "You are the best thing that ever happened to me." Later, when I was in the backyard, hesitant to return to the dying box as the sun dipped away, I found a patch of charred grass and a small circle of blackened stones and pebbles. An ash moon branded into a sea of wild green grass. I touched a gray rock, partially blackened by flame, to see if it was still hot. I felt proud and ashamed. For the record, I know I was lucky. I know I am lucky. I don't think you're stupid. I know I'm not your friend. I hope you can be proud of me.
It's a beautiful story.
Thank you.
What did you want us to get from that story? When you wrote that, what were you trying to work out?
In this book, I think it works as like almost like an interlude. You get that really kind of intense, violent, to me, important first story, the Finkelstein Five. Then you have the short interlude of, hey, this is like who I actually am. And then let's get back to the story. Let's get back to like this production I'm creating, which is the remaining stories in the book. It's like, this is there too, you know? And it might not be your mom, might not be there, but like this exists as well.
Yeah.
You know, this people, this love, basically.
Love is there too. Well, thank you so much. That was Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya reading from Friday Black. Thanks so much for joining us, Nana.
Thank you guys for having me.
The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. This episode was produced by myself and Vera Lynn Williams. It was edited by Karen Frillman, who is also our executive producer. It was mixed by Isaac Jones. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Ginny Casas, Marianne McCune, and Christopher Wirth, with help this week from Kim Nowaki. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Please do keep in touch. You can follow me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. And thanks again for listening. Take care of yourselves.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.